I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. You probably know most Americans aren't putting enough away for savings or retirement. A study by the think tank Financial Finesse shows that women are, by and large, even less prepared than men when it comes to fiscal wellness. And millennial women are hurting even more. Today, the smart money experts discuss the gender gap in financial wellness. The gap's been shrinking recently, but you might be surprised why. We'll also discuss changes people can make to improve their situations and becoming more fit financially. The problems are fairly easy to identify, but the solutions can be hard to execute. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. There are a lot of gaps in American life. There's the gender gap in politics. There's the pay gap that documents how women aren't paid as much as men. And then there's the financial wellness gap when it comes to our collective finances, meaning that women aren't as prepared for retirement as men are. Today, we'll talk about this gender gap when it comes to our financial wellness and why women score lower than men. And also, we'll take a look at our financial fitness today. With us, David Jackson is a financial advisor with Waddell & Reed. David, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Steve.
Barbara McMahon is president of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside. Barbara, good morning.
Hi, Steve.
Sandy Weaver is with Petrovic Weaver Financial Services. Sandy, nice to have you again.
Same here, Steve.
Well, let's start with some current events here, gang. The first quarter corporate earnings release kicked off last week. Some new insights into what's going on out there. David, give us some sense of what the first quarter corporate earnings told us.
Well, the stock market had a good first quarter, very good, solid first quarter, but things have kind of
leveled off
a little bit. Yeah. So, a little bit of the exuberance that we saw early on in the quarter, it's kind of calmed down.
Why have things leveled off, Barbara?
Well, there's a sense that perhaps the prices are undeserved. That David used the word exuberance, and I think that's a good one.
They're too high.
They might be a little too high. Last week, the market fell about 1% on its high. It's fallen about 3% since its March 1st high. So there's been some global issues. If you look at certain ratios that we like to look at, PE ratios, they look like they're a little high.
Mm-hmm.
Mainly, I think what the market is seeking is something to justify these high prices.
So when we say, Sandy, that the first quarter was a robust one for the stock market, what figures back that up?
We're looking at corporate earnings. Interest rates are very low. Corporate earnings are projected to come in at 9% for the first quarter, and you follow that with 4% and 8% back into the two last quarters of last year. So those are pretty good moves up in corporate earnings if we get them.
What are we seeing when it comes to large cap stocks out there, David, in terms of increases?
Well, they're up about 5.5 or 5.35 year to date. So the big companies actually did well.
Okay. So again, a pretty good first quarter. We'll see where we go in quarter number two here. Barbara, what does this mean for interest rates? The Fed has raised interest rates another quarter point in March. What about that?
Well, and that was widely expected. I don't think the quarter of a percent in March mattered too much because it was pretty well baked into the market. But I think what's more important is that the Fed has announced that they've got more coming. Two more interest rates rate increases are expected this year. And interestingly, last week, Trump made the comment that he really thought interest rates should remain low. And so I think he injected just a little uncertainty in that market, too.
Well, the Fed, the notion that it's increasing the interest rates, that's been widely anticipated, too, though, right?
Well, it has.
Mm-hmm.
One of the thoughts with the Fed increasing interest rates is that you need to raise the interest rates so that if something unforeseen happens in the economy, they can drop them again. They've run out of bullets. There's no wiggle room. And so they need to get back to some kind of place where they have options that they can use if the economy requires it.
Sandy Weaver, does the president have any say in what the market interest rates are out there?
Theoretically, he's not supposed to, but
yes.
He does. He can get rid of Janet Yellen, who runs the Federal Reserve Board. You know, and during his campaign, he said he didn't like her much. Mm-hmm. Now, all of a sudden, you know, he does tend to like her more. She's been very dovish in terms of keeping rates low for him. And with his infrastructure plans, he might want and need low rates. Mm-hmm. She's due to retire, and she has indicated she doesn't want another term. She's due to retire next year, I think around about halfway through the year.
So you might think that she could survive at least that long and then maybe step away.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's turn to our main topic today and some of the key takeaways from the 2016 Gender Gap in Financial Wellness Study by Financial Finesse. This is based on a tool designed and developed by the think tank of certified financial planner professionals. The report focused mainly on women under 30, which they refer to as millennial women, and addressed four main topics. Let's talk about the first one here, retirement underpreparedness. To cover expected retirement expenses, a typical 25-year-old woman would have to save 12.6% of her income compared to 11.1% for a 25-year-old man. Is this take-home or gross pay, David? What's your sense of that?
Well, it's gross pay, but it doesn't matter. It's basically just a simple calculation that women are going to live longer than men, and so they need their retirement assets to last longer. And because they're not making quite as much as men, they need to save more. It's just a simple calculation.
But Barbara, as we've talked about in this show any number of times, what a world we live in. Who's going to save almost 13% of her income when they're just getting started in the marketplace? And that's just a big chunk.
It is just a big chunk. And that's one of the challenges. The other thing that you have going on with women is that they also have higher lifetime health care costs. So the deck is kind of stacked from the beginning. And the problem with a woman starting out is that they spend on themselves. They tend to feather the nest. I mean, if you go into the apartment of a single man and open the refrigerator, you're going to find three cans of Coke and a killer stereo system on shelves on, blocks.
Mm-hmm. Steve, we're going to have some male bashing here.
Not my intention. But he doesn't have anything else to do with his money, so he starts to save. Whereas a woman in her first apartment, she'll have the new sofa, it will be lovely, but she will spend for her comfort instead of getting to the business of saving for her future. So even if she is in a position to save, she's not making that good decision. But you're absolutely correct. 12% is a pretty hefty amount of money.
Sandy, do you talk to young people who are 25 years old and you look them right in the eye and you say, we need 13% of your income to go into this account, which you won't touch for the next 45 years? And what do they say to you?
Well, no, we don't have clients that I have said that to. But what I do go to Roastery and I talk to the women there, and people behind the counter are, young men and women. And women tend to, I'll take exception with Barbara's scenario, women tend to make it happen at lower wage levels.
Hmm.
For example, one young woman I talked to yesterday afternoon at my Roastery said, she used to use the pension plan at her prior place of work. She doesn't feel she's good at math. Women are always saying that. But and then my second question was, do you think you handle your finances well? And she goes, I handle my cash flow very well.
Hmm.
And then, so she went on. So I do think, and the study shows that women make it happen at lower levels and men, young men don't save as much.
So it's just the opposite of what Barbara said.
I know. Yes, that's what I want to take
the
exception.
The men are buying those stereo systems here. Well, and there's some irony here, David, in the sense that when you're young, that's the time to sock away the money because it gives that money more time to work for you, right?
Yeah, the power of compounding really starts from those early dollars that you save, but then you also have that that challenge of kids right out of college, they got debt. The college loans and all that they got to deal with, plus trying to get the apartment established and all. So where does the money come from? So a lot of times my early conversation with these young people is save what you can. Let's at least get you on track. And then, keep in mind that as you get raises, we're going to make adjustments to build you up. So maybe you can't start with 12% or 11% right away. Let's start with something and then, build towards it as we go.
I mean, not to belabor this point, but to ask someone to say, hey, if you want to be on track, you've got to go at 13% when you're 25 years old. I mean, that's just crazy to me.
Well, not I mean, crazy, the but world, it, it's a hard conversation.
The world is changing for my parents' generation. My parents, of course, never had to worry about any of that.
Right.
They had that 13% to spend on whatever they needed to spend it on. Mm-hmm. But the world now says, no, you need 13% right away going into the bank.
And then, you know, your parents also had the benefit of a pension plan. So
that's right.
They automatically knew money was being saved for their retirement, where people nowadays, unless you do it, you're not having anything going in for your retirement. So
Barbara, you guys are saying, okay, 13% for retirement, and you're saying we need an emergency account too. So you got to stick away, what, 4 or 5% for that. And at what point do you have money left over to go down to the Power and Light District and have a good time, you know?
You have to strike the balance, and that's the catch. You have to strike the balance between the money that you'll spend now and the money that you will spend later. Mm-hmm. And I have to say that the millennials I deal with, you mentioned our parents, they come into my office, and the baby boomers have been great examples for them of what not to do,
mm-hmm.
because we're not prepared either. And so these young people will come in and say, I'm looking at my parents, they're not going to retire comfortably. I do not want to be my parents, and I want you to tell me how to make that happen.
Well, so they're already seeing the examples of their
exactly.
own moms and dads.
Yeah, and so the millennials that would seek out a financial advisor are very, very motivated because they've seen some bad examples, not quite sure what will work, but they know what they don't want to do.
Well, to go back to our main point here, this disparity between men and women, even if you assume equal pay in their 20s, women need to save 28% more, Sandy?
That's the figure,
because
yeah.
of the health care and the other factors we're talking about?
Well, no. It's to get the same standard of living as a man in retirement, women don't have to save 12.6. They have to save 28% because of the equal pay issue. So if you combine the equal pay issue and the living longer, more health care issue, then women, young millennial women, need to save 28%. And that says that there's really no time to not be smart about this. You know, you need to, you know, get started on the steps of financial planning on day one. You know, have the emergency fund, start taking care of the student debt. Hopefully you didn't rent it up too high in college, and then you start saving.
Wow.
You have to have your priorities.
Women are becoming more proactive on financial planning, but progress is said to be slow. David, why is it slow?
Well, it's kind of the point that you made. It's
mm-hmm.
tough.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're thinking about talking about disposable income or that excess income after your basic necessities are being met. And for the average millennial, their basic necessities are using up just about all their cash flow. So,
mm-hmm.
you know, starting to plan for long term, well, you got to live right now, too.
Barbara, these numbers I'm looking at suggest that 54% of women were prepared in 2012. In 2015, it's 55%. That number strikes me as, you know, really not bad, considering how a lot of folks approach this stuff.
Well, and that's interesting because I look at those same numbers and think we're just creeping. I would like to have seen a higher percent
of women
prepared in 2015.
I
mean, 1% over 3 years, I'm not impressed by that number.
How many people come into your office, though, Sandy? Are they where they need to be in your view? I bet that number is pretty small.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
We see most of millennials that we see, frankly, are the adult children of clients. And I'll be quite honest, I am impressed by how well they do. They do wonderfully well. But it's the people that don't seek you out that are making up these numbers.
Mm-hmm.
You see what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's where the problem comes
yeah.
up. Okay. Yeah. Okay. So some work to do for women. How about the effect of career breaks? I mean, women choose to be stay-at-home moms, even if they have college degrees and continue to pay student loan debt. The earlier a woman chooses to leave the workforce, the higher percentage of income she must save to meet spending needs after 65. Again, this creates a need to plan and prioritize savings in her 20s, right, David?
Yeah, you know, you think about how many men do you know that when the children are little, the guy's going to stay home and watch the kids. I mean, it happens, but it's not common.
Mm-hmm.
When mom gets sick, how many men do you know that are going to take some time off their job to take care of mom or go part-time so they can take care of mom or dad? It happens, but not very often. But very typically, the female is the one who's going to take on those responsibilities, and that, you know, eats into their ability to save and plan for their own future.
In fact, Barbara, the impact on women, the interruption this can have on their career tracks, their financial tracks, it's pretty profound.
Oh, it's huge. And that's one of the more interesting points of this survey, I thought. If you take the break early because you're going to raise your children, According to the survey, an early break raises the amount that the woman needs to save by $209,000, whereas the second scenario that David mentioned, you're staying home caring for, example, an ailing parent, but you're doing it at a much later age.
Mm-hmm.
That woman, late in career, she needs to save an additional $95,000. And there's a big difference between a 20-year-old needing to save $209,000 and somebody in their mid-50s needing to save an additional $95,000. And it just goes to the point that the earlier the career break occurs, the more you have to save. You just have to plan for that. And that's one of the things the study stressed is if you are planning to step aside in your career at some point, you need to get started saving more right out of the gate and just factor it into your retirement and your savings plans.
Man, this is such sober stuff, Sandy. Yeah.
And then you have to hope that your marriage stays together, because if divorce comes along, you know, earning capacity is everything. If you take that hit to your earning capacity, if you step down for a few years, you know, to get that career back on track so you can earn enough, because divorce won't set you even. I mean, cut you free even. So.
Okay. Then there's this confidence gap when it comes to investing. What do we know about that, David?
Well, Sandy was giving me a hard time about that one before the show even started.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's generally thought that men are overconfident when it comes to their investment ability. And I have to admit that that tends to be true. It's a very, very much a generalization. But there are a lot of guys out there that really think they're experts on everything dealing with the stock market and investing. And they
Why
become
would
a little
anybody
bit,
think they're an expert on that stuff?
I know, exactly, right?
Me. Yeah.
Yeah, but you know, and so being overconfident leads you to take way too much risk in a lot of cases. And in a lot of cases, because women are not quite as confident, they're more likely to seek out help. Say, well, help me find an expert to tell me what to do, because I really admit I don't know what to do.
Mm-hmm.
And where this guy is like, well, I'm gonna put all my money in this, you know, this hedge fund or this super secret, plan I've heard about.
A friend of a friend told me about this one fund.
And it can't miss.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, there is something to that confidence gap.
Do you buy that, Barbara, that this gap between the sexes when it comes to confidence and investing?
Absolutely. And it goes just beyond confidence if their perspective is different. So if a man has a good year, it's because he is a good investment person and that outcome was something that he created. A woman has a longer time frame, and she will be more cautious. And the studies show that the woman will make better decisions for the long term because she is cautious and analytical. So being cautious isn't a bad thing necessarily, but it can prevent a woman or make her leery of decisions that could be good decisions for her because it's just a little outside her comfort level. And, just anecdotally, I have to explain a great deal more to my women clients than I do from my men. And my men will, the men clients will go, hey, that sounds great. Do I need to sign something? And a woman will go, well, I don't understand why you said that about this, because that seems to contradict what you said about that. And could we just compare these two? Because I want to make sure I really understand.
Sounds like there's a PhD dissertation waiting to be written on what we're talking about here. You notice the same thing?
Absolutely. Annie? Yeah. And even when we get hired, you know, the difference in interviewing techniques, you know, the women, we usually, when they call in, we'll send them a booklet of questions to ask financial planners, generic. And when the women come in, they will have a list of questions and sort of fry our toes, run us through the gauntlet. But men operate differently. They will talk with you. They'll look up your bio before you come in. But it's a different kind of, it's not an interview or research. It's do they like you?
Or not.
Yeah.
Or not.
Yeah.
Okay. I think that's how we guys are.
How do we feel about this?
How about estate planning and life insurance concerns, David? What have you noticed there?
Well, I can't say that I've noticed a big. I do notice that women are underinsured in a lot of cases as far as life insurance, and I think part of it is they don't value in a lot of cases how much they contribute to the family and to the household. So. It's pretty traditional that the father will have more life insurance on him than the mom. But if they're making about the same amount of money, why should there be a difference?
Mm-hmm.
So I have noticed that.
Yeah. What else have you noticed when it comes to long-term planning here, Barbara?
Well, with long-term planning, what the study said was that both genders are planning at about the same rate, but unfortunately, it's way under what they should be planning.
Mm-hmm.
They should take better care of life insurance, as David mentioned, estate planning, beneficiaries, making sure that the person that they want to receive the money when they die is the person named on the account, and change that as life situations change. So frankly, neither group is doing particularly well at this one.
We're talking about the gender gap when it comes to financial planning. If you want to join our conversation, 816-235-2888 is the number here, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. We have a tweet here from Sarah Eggers in Kansas City. She says, every year I increase my 401k contribution by my cost of living raise. If I could live off that salary last year, I can this year as well. That's what she says. And you guys applaud that kind of thinking, right, Sandy?
Yeah, the studies show that at lower levels of income, you know, women make it happen and men don't. You know, for the same, if they're both earning 40, the women will be able to get money into a pension plan and the men won't.
What about the whole idea of financial mentorship? What does that mean and what's that about? It sounds like a really good idea. Barbara?
Financial mentorship is one of the things that there is a hope that an employer could do, bring people in to hold classes, lunch and learns, things like that, where you would just start with the basics, you would bring in an expert, and you would make it available to your employees and help them, just give them the basics and help them learn what's going on. I would expand that to say financial mentorship. I'd love to see parents doing it also, showing good examples and bad examples. I used to know a couple who would allow their children to pay the bills. One child would do it 1 month, one child would do it the next month. So they always knew exactly where the family budget was and what was going to savings and what was going to spending. I thought that was brilliant. That's great financial mentorship.
There still seems to be some reticence to have family, at least for a lot of families, to engage in the kind of mentorship you're talking about there, Barbara.
Oh, there absolutely is. And I guess the answer is we need to get past that.
Mm-hmm.
We just really do. And I think that perhaps is the reason that the study suggested that it be done at an employer level, because one of the things about millennials is they do take advice. They do seek advice from their elders. That is a characteristic of the group. They consult with their parents, which I think is very interesting. And so part of the reason the study focused on millennials is there is so much ability for them to make a difference, a positive difference, and, you know, by the time they retire 35 years out, to be successful. So if the workplace can provide them with good information, if the parents can provide them with good information, there's a chance that although this generation is falling behind now, we can make them successful.
You know, it seems to me there are things that can be done, and some of the proposed solutions here make sense to me, particularly for companies that aren't offering pensions anymore. You could do things, Cindy, like offering longer parental leave, offering on-site child care. Those kinds of things would make such a huge difference in the lives of the people who toil away at their organizations.
Oh, yeah, and there are several things that companies can do that don't particularly cost them a lot of money. You can get a pension where you don't have to have an owner's employer match. But what the beauty of it is, you've given your employees the option of salary deferral. You know, so they can get, you know, $12,000-$13,000 into a pension plan each year. So so a lot of those don't need to cost the company that much money.
Are you seeing much movement in those directions, David? Companies who are saying, okay, yeah, we're not offering pensions right now, so we can do X, Y, and Z to help our workers out.
I wish we were. I mean, it seems like such a simple and, as Sandy said, an inexpensive solution that would make, you know, a huge difference. But I can't say that I've seen a lot of movement in that area myself. Have you guys?
I would agree with you, David.
Yeah,
just not seeing a whole lot of push that way, which is kind of too bad. Okay, let's do this. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation here about the gender gap when it comes to financial planning, financial readiness, all those things. Again, our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. In our second half today, we'll talk about financial fitness and what that's all about. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. On Friday's show, we spoke with Kansas City trumpeter Herman Mahari and listened to some of his debut album. You can find that conversation at kcur.org/uptodate. Coming up this week, U.S. Representatives Kevin Yoder and Emmanuel Cleaver join us on Wednesday, and we'll examine the economics behind the rise in income inequality on Thursday. We'll wrap up the week looking at the art of exploration and discovery. That's coming up this week on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour we're talking about financial wellness and particularly this idea of a gender gap when it comes to how well prepared and how men and women handle their money. We're visiting with David Jackson, who's on the financial advisor with Waddell & Reed, Barbara McMahon, president of Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside. Sandy Weaver is with Petrovic Weaver Financial Services. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Well, let's talk about, before we scoot on here, this whole notion of adequate life insurance and long-term disability insurance and maybe even long-term care. Are we seeing concerns in those areas, David?
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things we didn't really get to, but the long-term care issue, I think, is really huge, because I don't know if you've ever been to a nursing home before, but if you've gone to a nursing home, anecdotally, I would say maybe 80% of the people there are female. And so how are you paying for that care? Long-term care insurance is probably, you know, one of the most efficient ways to provide for that care.
What does long-term care insurance typically supply? What does it offer?
It provides either a daily or a monthly benefit if your doctor assumes that you or presumes that you need care, whether you're in a nursing home or at-home care. You know, so you can have a private nurse, or you can be in, you know, full care facility or a limited care facility, and, you know, have more, maintain your standard of living or standard of life while having some care provided for you.
Do a lot of Americans buy those kinds of products? Has that become pretty typical, or is it still a little unusual, or do you have any feel for that?
I think it's still a little unusual because, frankly, it's costly. And the industry has undergone some enormous changes over the last, maybe 5 years. So as David mentioned, in most long care situations, it typically is a woman, and that is because she has cared for the man in her life, and she's the one left behind. So she's the one who really does need this insurance. So one of the things that has happened, because they realized women were going on claim, is they raised the rates for women. So the people who need it most, it's actually a higher cost. But on the other hand, it provides an amazing benefit, and it provides for a full range of care, nursing home to stay at home. I mean, none of my clients have ever come in and said, you know, I'd like to spend the last 4 years of my life in a nursing home. Can you help me out here? They really want to stay at home. And so a good policy will let you stay at home, will let you in adult daycare, will let you in assisted living, will take you to skilled nursing.
I'm just trying to put myself in the shoes of a millennial out there, though. If you're 25 years old and you buy a long-term policy, the advantage is it's cheaper then, right? The disadvantage might be, is this company going to be around 40 years from now to service the account that I've been diligently paying on for the last 40 years?
Yeah, we usually recommend clients start taking a hard look at it when they're 55, before 60.
Oh, really?
There's a price jump at 60. Yeah, so we usually don't, you know, get serious about it with clients, start recommending till then.
Mid-50s. Yeah, a long-term disability would be something more appropriate for a millennial.
Yeah.
Then that's basically saying if you get sick or you get hurt on the job or something and you just can't work for an extended period of time, where's the income going to come from? So the long-term disability is for that type of scenario. But as you get a little bit older and you start thinking, you know, at some point I'm going to get older and may have to go to a nursing home or need a nurse to come to my home, that's when long-term care comes into play.
So if you buy a policy, a long-term care policy, you're between 55 and 60. Not that any one of us at this table might fall into that category, but I'm just saying maybe me. But what's that going to cost me a month if I'm going to go down that road, just roughly?
Usually we're finding when we get quotes for our clients, we use a couple different sources. It's about $3,000 a year per head.
$3,000 a year, so a month you're looking at 200 something a month.
Yeah. And so, you know, you think about insurance like you think about a car, though. You can have a car with all the bells and whistles, or you can have a car that's a stripped down version. So if you're somebody who says, oh, you know what, I have a lot of assets and I also have a really good pension, so I know I'm going to have money coming in, well, maybe I go with the very, you know, low level type of policy without all the bells and whistles because I don't need it. But if you're somebody who said, well, you know, I don't have any guaranteed income have decent assets and I want to make sure I leave something to my kids, maybe you do shell out a little bit more money for a more, you know, progressive policy.
Yeah.
It kind of depends.
And bringing this back to the millennials, this matters to millennials because as they age, they're the ones who are likely to care for these people.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And so we sometimes have discussions with our younger clients about, I'm terrified if something happens to my mother because I have no idea how she's going to pay for a nursing home and I will have to quit my job to care for her.
So that's it. I'll have my sons pay for my long-term care insurance. That's what you're thinking about here, right?
Yes.
Here's $250 a month, Nick, here, to take this on, right? Okay.
Let me know if that works for you.
Yeah, absolutely. 816-235-2888 is the phone number here. We're talking about the gender gap when it comes to financial preparedness. 816-235-2888 or tweet us at KCUR up to date. Jeff from Blue Springs. Jeff, good morning. Jeff, you there? Hello. You there? Maybe not. You know, the other thing I was thinking about was this idea that for so many millennials, you know, these are folks who are working for themselves, typically working for a number of different clients, maybe working out of their homes or whatever. Sandy, that strikes me as another challenge when it comes to having to patch together, you know, a financial long-term security plan when you're working on your own. You got to pay, you know, extra benefits and everything else.
Absolutely. Millennials approach employment a little bit differently than the baby boomers do. One-third of millennials are working in the, quote, gig economy, quote. That means that they patch together projects and consulting jobs. I know some folks in Bike Club like that. I know some young women over at Central Exchange who are doing that. That's pretty common these days, and we don't relate to it that much here around the table, but that's what we're seeing. So if you are doing a Schedule C, you have your own business, and you're, you know, bringing on different jobs every year with different businesses, you know, you need to earn probably 25 to 30% more than a counterpart who's doing the same job at a big company because of the employee benefits that you have to provide for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so just you have to gross it up and run your numbers that way.
Okay. That's a particular challenge too, isn't it, David?
Oh, absolutely. But what I wanted to chime in on is something I didn't want to let time get away from us. So we talk about this gender gap and the wage gap that, you know, ensues from that. I think there's some good trends going on that are going to kind of reverse that. And so the big one is about 56% of all college graduates now are female. And so if we make the assumption that having a college degree pays more than not having one, so that gender gap or the wage gap is eventually going to go away. And then you couple that with the fact that the power of unions and the jobs that guys had at unions that were good paying jobs are slowly disappearing.
Right.
That gap is slowly closing itself automatically.
That's interesting. Let's go to some phone calls here. Grover from Independence. Grover, you're on Up to Date.
Well, my question is, my wife and I have joined stock clubs and I've tried to get her interested in her own retirement and, you know, for future, but she just, it's not anything she wants to do. Is there a group of just women that she can, you know, gather with that would help her learn something to this on a monthly basis where, you know, it's not, okay, you take over it. You know, I don't understand that. You just do it.
So what Grover's asking is, what if you have one spouse who simply isn't interested in saving for retirement a whole lot, Sandy? Yeah.
Yeah, I am aware of about three or four groups at Central Exchange, which is mostly women, but they get together on a monthly basis and explore financial topics.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're, you know, a beginner, that would be a good place to learn. One other thing is I did, and I don't know what your age is, I did go through our client base and I just counted up the first 15 couples. So this is not, you know, exact science, but of the first 15 couples, and I think we'll all agree that usually it's either one or the other who handles the finances, most of them.
Typically.
Of the first 15 couples, and these are people that are in their 50s and 60s, you know, about 2/3 of those had men handling the finances. But when I went back and went through the client base and counted just the young couples, that was 50-50. And so I think we're seeing a change going on.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And I guess what I would tell Grover is that sometimes managing money and an interest in investments simply isn't in that person's skill set.
Mm-hmm.
And it has nothing to do with gender.
Absolutely.
So
dragging him or her along to a bunch of meetings that explain all this stuff might be an utter waste of time.
Well, Possibly, but I would say that getting to know the financial advisor will be critical, because if something happens to Grover, she is going to need somebody that she trusts and depends on. So I would encourage her to sit through the boring meetings just so she has a good sense that something positive can happen.
Okay. Let's go to Jeff from Blue Springs. Jeff, you're on Up Today. Thanks for calling back, Jeff.
I have a question. I work for a company that has less than 100 employees, and I'm 60 years old, and they cap my 401 contribution to 15%, which is far less than the $26,000 that I'm allowed by the IRS to contribute to my 401k.
Is that allowable? Is that your question, Jeff? Yeah.
Yeah, is that allowable by a company?
Yeah, there's some top-heavy rules that are out there that basically say, and especially if affects smaller employers more, where if most of the contributions going into the retirement plan are going to the key executives and the people with a higher income, then the IRS is saying, well, you know, this plan doesn't look fair because it's just benefiting the highly paid, and they'll put some caps on it. So that is possible. That's why there are a lot of plans out there that will make automatic matching contributions to everybody, so that they can kind of balance that level out. It's called a safe harbor plan.
So Jeff might have to go outside his own company to save more, obviously, if that's what he wants to do.
Yeah, he may have to do some other things on top of what he's doing in the 401k.
I hope that helps, Jeff.
It does. Thank you very much.
Yep, good luck. Appreciate it. Again, our number here, 816-235-2888, and you can also tweet us at KCUR Up Today as we talk about the gender gap when it comes to financial planning. Well, let's turn to financial fitness and what this means, what steps people can do to improve their situations. The problems have oftentimes been defined, yet a lot of people still don't want to make improvements here. What are some of the common reasons why people don't want to improve their financial situations, David?
Well, you know, the simple one is that there's not a deadline. You know, we got the tax deadline coming up here tomorrow, basically.
Tomorrow.
And we have to get that done. Otherwise, we know there's some pain for not doing it.
Right.
When it comes to financial planning, there's really not a deadline. You know, so we can, it's easy for us to say the sooner you start, the better you're off you're going to be. But there's not a hard date that says you better start, you know, when you turn 30, or you better start when you turn 35. So it's so easy to procrastinate. It's just one of those things. I'll get to it one of these days, and then next thing you know, you're 45, you're 49, and you're like, man, I wish I should have, would have, could have, you know.
Yeah.
It's like you just, you know, ran out of time. So
yeah. Barbara, along those lines, what do you say?
Well, I would also say that setting goals is important. It's interesting how many people in their 50s will show up in our office and say, I've been saving forever, and I don't know if it's enough, and I don't even know if it's invested in the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
So at some point along the line, it would have been nice to set the goal, hit the target, because you can't set targets. I agree with David that there's no hard deadline out there, but we can come close to approximating what you'll need at a certain date, at a certain lifestyle, and that would be useful. It would be useful in getting you moving, and it would also be useful to know what the goal is so you can hit it, and then adjust the goal as life happens. I mean, John Lennon notably said, you know, life is what happens while you make other plans. You have children, you inherit money, things just happen. And that's when you go back to your advisor and say, here's what we're dealing with now, let's refocus a little bit.
Sandy, is that when people begin to really focus on this stuff, they sort of hit the big 5-0 and they start thinking, you know, all this retirement talk isn't so abstract after all. It really means something now.
Absolutely. That's the age when we see them. But there are lots of good things that you can do to make your road much easier. And one of those, if you look at the work of Benarzi and Thaler, I've read Richard Thaler, I'm more familiar with him, but make the right choices be automatic in your life. So if you take their study on what Germany and Austria did with organ donation, in Germany, their compliance rate, 12% of Germans donate their organs. And what they do, the same thing we do, is on our driver's license, if you want to donate your organs, you sign your name on that little dotted line there, and you donate your organs. But Austria made the right decision, if you agree with their right, to be automatic. So on the Austrian driver's license, you sign if you do not want your organs donated. You want to know what Austria's compliance rate is? 99% of those people donate their organs. So if you get a raise at work, you know, make it automatic that a third of that goes right into the pension plan. Don't even look at
it. Right.
You know, that's huge.
It makes it easier. Yeah.
A lot of 401k plans now are doing that same thing. They have what's called an opt-out. where you're automatically enrolled in the 401k plan unless you sign something saying, I don't want to be in it.
Yeah.
And I think that's huge, because you ask a young person, do you want to save for something so when you're 40 years down the road, they're going to say, well, I got plenty of time to worry about it. But if it's automatically done and you have to say, no, I don't want to do it, then it changes the results.
Well, the trick with some of that stuff, though, it seems to me, is that when it's automatic, you don't pay much attention to it,
Absolutely.
Which means you may not be rejiggering your investment ratios very often,
right,
and be aware of where the money's going. So it does have a downside to it, too, it seems to me.
Well, but I think the upside is so much greater.
Okay.
You know, just automatically doing something, and then, you know, if you can get a little bit of advice and, you know, get some advice on where to put your money and how it should be treated and not be constantly jiggering with it and messing it up, you know, your results are more than likely going to be a lot better.
Yeah. Barbara?
And that's one of the reasons, Steve, that they invented target date funds, so that the people that don't have the time or the inclination to look at it will be in an investment that is appropriate, quote unquote, to the year in which they might retire.
Mm-hmm.
And so typically in the plans that David mentioned, where you're automatically in unless you opt out, if you make no investment choice, the money goes into a target date fund, which
right,
usually is a pretty good investment.
We have a tweet here from Anna May in Kansas City. I'm self-employed and living gig to gig. What are your suggestions for someone like me in regards to financial planning?
I would go through the basic six steps, make sure I have an emergency fund, make sure I have my debt paid down. If I don't have my debt paid down, I give myself a plan. And I would say I can't touch 20% of my money for a while. That
mm-hmm.
has to go to those two goals, and learn to live without that. And then once I'm through with those two steps, I'd go right on to the savings and start saving. Make sure you have the right insurance in place and then start saving it. If people can live on a lot less than they think they need.
Hmm. So you guys can sit somebody down and go through all this stuff with them, retirement savings, insurance coverage, beneficiaries being designated properly,
yeah,
all that stuff.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you get people who come in sometimes and say, I don't really know who my beneficiaries are. I don't even know where to look.
Oh, yeah. Sometimes people are divorced and they have an X on their primary beneficiary line.
Yeah.
You know, and that's going to happen. That's law then.
Yeah. Okay. How about successful techniques to make some progress moving forward, David? What would you point to there?
Well, I think the key one would be living within your means.
Mm-hmm.
Easy to say, hard to do.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like we all want stuff. And there are commercials playing daily, every second, trying to get you to buy more stuff.
Yeah.
And so you just have to have the discipline of saying, I got X number of dollars to work with, and other stuff is just going to have to wait. Just living within your means is probably the key for the vast majority of Americans out here.
You know what's great about being a public radio talk show host is the stuff I want typically involves books and CDs. I get lots of books and CDs here on Up to Date. It's saved me a bunch of money over the years. Barbara, what else would you point to?
Well, I would say when it comes to spending, it needs to be a conscious decision. This is kind of building on what David says, I think, but it shouldn't be reactive. Oh, I guess I need, and you go out and do it. It should be a conscious decision made in advance. You look at whether you have the cash, if it has to go to a credit card, that should lean you against that decision.
Mm-hmm.
But it should be part of a decision process, not I've got a little time, just got paid, think I'll go shopping Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
That is the wrong way to approach it.
Yeah, yeah. So anything else you'd point to there?
Yeah, I think become very familiar with what I call the monkey drill, that Thaler and Bernardsky did some studies in this area. They gave a group of monkeys one apple, and that group, you know, was a happy group of monkeys. They gave another group of monkeys two apples, took away an apple, and that group of monkeys, when they, you know, measured, you know, their emotional status, was an angry group of monkeys. So people are the same way. If you don't have it, you know, if you never took that raise, if you only saw 2/3 of the raise versus a third of the raise.
I'm wondering where you're going with that.
Yeah.
I'll tie it back. Just wait with me.
You weren't the only one, by the way. The host is sitting here wondering, too.
How does the monkey drill play? But if you never had it, you never lose it. So stop thinking of saving for retirement or paying off debt as losing something. You know, don't ever put it on your plate in the first place. Know that about yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Use that to your advantage.
That's really interesting.
Thank you, Sandy.
Going back to this notion of common obstacles, David, one thing you do hear about is this idea that you shouldn't follow the latest trends. You know, international stocks are hot right now. By the time I hear it, chances are they were hot and they're no longer hot, right?
Oh, that is so true, too. And I've got a buddy that He invested so much money in the, I don't know if you heard about the scheme, the Iraqi dinar. It was a currency play.
Oh, yes.
And
yes.
He just dumped a ton of money into this because that's the next big thing that he's going to, you know, 1,000 times his return on his investment. It's just, you know, people just get crazy. They hear stuff and it's like, okay, I want to get rich quick and don't listen to your neighbors.
Yeah. That's boy, that's really true. What else would you point to when it comes to common obstacles that people should prevent people from making improvements to their financial situations? Barbara, you know, overlooking the importance of insurance for any risk you don't want to bear.
That, to me, is critical. And typically, if you sit down with an advisor, that is often the first thing they'll look at. Because
is your insurance?
Is your insurance. Because a bad... you know, a disability, an unexpected death, especially of a spouse, that can derail you permanently if you haven't planned to replace that income. And one of the things I think David mentioned earlier was under insurance for the wife. I would argue not only does the wife need insurance if she is a wage earner, but also if she is not, because this statistic is outdated. Give me a better one if you guys have one. But the value of a homemaker services, last I saw, was about $70,000.
Mm.
And so mm-hmm. that person needs insurance too. So, again, we tell you that you should insure any risk that you don't want to bear, that you don't have the money set aside in an emergency fund.
Is there a rule of what is the rule of thumb for how much insurance any one person should have on his or her life?
About 5 to 10 times your wage. That's
five to ten times your wage.
That's real general.
It's so general. Yeah. Because if you don't have any kids or you don't have a spouse and you don't have anybody to leave anything to,
the
number goes way down. So mm-hmm. it just kind of depends. But
so it really varies and really depends
greatly. But that is a good rule of thumb, you know, at least get you in the ballpark.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else on successful techniques to make progress here? Automate your savings and investing. That's important. Making contributions into employer plan to get the match. That's key. What else would you point to there?
I would, if you're married, I think it's important to try to get yourselves on the same page with your finances, because we see a lot of folks who are, you know, coming at it from different angles. But, you know, with the baby boomers, 75% of them were white. With the millennials, 56% are white. So what that means is they're mirroring a different frame of reference when it comes to finances. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to talk about it openly. I think as Americans, we tend not to. I think we tend not to give it good placement. I would advise us to give it more time.
We're going to have to leave it right there. I want to thank our smart money experts once again for coming through for us. David Jackson with Waddell & Reed, Barbara McMahon with Innovest Financial Partners in Brookside, Sandy Weaver is with Petrovic Weaver Financial Services. Thank you all very much.
Great
to be
with
you. Conversation.
Thank you, Steve.
Yeah. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR up to date. You can follow me at Steve Kraske. Stay tuned all week. U.S. Representatives Emanuel Cleaver and Kevin Yoder join us on Wednesday. On Thursday, the economics behind the rise in income inequality. And on Friday, the art of exploration and discovery. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Claire Tatacoro. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.